You're listening to the Liberty News Radio Network, and this is the Political Cesspool. The Political Cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program, and here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Everybody, welcome to tonight's live broadcast of TPC this Saturday evening, November the 20th, our last time together before Thanksgiving, and we hope each and every one of you tonight will have safe travels and warm fellowship with friends and family in the coming week. But first, we've got a powerhouse broadcast coming your way this evening. Kyle Rittenhouse has been found not guilty, and jury deliberation is underway in the Charlottesville trial. Guest commentators Warren Balog and Ramsey Paul will be joining me to break down all the courtroom drama as these important cases rapidly draw to a close. And to kick things off this evening, we will start, as we have been doing over the course of the last month, leading with Charlottesville and helping me break apart what's been going on there over the course of the last week is the aforementioned Warren Balog, making his first appearance on this program, one that I hope will be followed by many others. Warren, how are you?
I'm doing great, James, and it's an honor to finally be on here.
Yeah, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, Warren and I knew each other through reputation only until, about a couple of months ago. We were at an event that I had a hand in organizing, and we just hit it straight off, as you would expect. And there was something that was just really interesting that Warren shared with me. Warren, do you want to tell him the story that I'm talking about?
Yeah, we discovered that we were both cut our teeth politically in the Buchanan campaign of the summer of 2000, actually the whole year of 2000. And you were also a delegate, as I was, to the convention in Long Beach, when Buchanan kind of wrested control of the Reform Party from what turned out to be the former, like kind of the Perot faction holdovers. But, that was an amazing experience. I wish, it's funny, James, like, you know what I'm talking about, but nobody else knows about what a crazy thing that convention was. But yeah, I was 18 years old, right out of high school. And I was a delegate. We had six delegates from the state of West Virginia, and there had been a very contentious battle for control of the Reform Party because there was about $12.5 million in federal matching funds that were at stake there.
Yes.
That were left over from the previous Perot run, and so there was an incredibly contentious battle to take, you know, who was going to be the nominee, and the Perot faction ended up going with a man named John Hagelin. And all the Pat Buchanan people all sort of marshaled their forces from around the country. I went there with my father, you know, and he has a long history. He already 30 years in politics, but he had sort of stepped away. And he had been more in the what you would call the radical right. My father was active with William Pierce with the Alliance many years ago and the NSWPP before that. And also with David Duke's campaign, he was real active in 1988 when David Duke ran for president. But I was, you know, I was born in 1982, so that was all before my adulthood. And when I was a kid, my dad really was not that politically involved. But in high school, I took an interest in politics as well, and we talked a lot, and we got into things together. And when the Buchanan campaign came up, we were both just like, let's do what we can. And we went to a convention in West Virginia when the Buchanan people, Pat was actually there. I met him for the first time. We didn't know he was going to be there. And there was a battle for control of West Virginia. And then I spent the whole summer, I think you did too, doing ballot access petitioning, which, boy, what a lesson. That's a lesson in how democracy works in America that I will never forget. And then it culminated with us being delegates for the Long Beach Convention. So, yeah, it was just amazing to find out that you were there, that you were part of that. And I think also you organized the one in there was one in Tennessee, wasn't there? There was one in, I think, in Nashville.
Yeah, that's right. It was the one in 2001 at the Nashville Renaissance that I had a hand. I mean, the Tennessee Reform Party at that time was the host state delegation.
Yeah, I was there as well.
We
so,
did it.
So
this is just so interesting to me. I mean, this is insider baseball, I guess, to people who weren't there and wouldn't remember the name John Hanglin or the ballot access requirements and going out and getting. But I. It's just amazing. So I turned 20 years old in the summer of 2000. I've told the story many, many times on the air. But that year changed the trajectory of my life. Getting involved in that campaign, it whetted my appetite for activism, and I was looking for ways after all of that ended to continue to apply myself, and it led into my own campaign and then, of course, into radio, and the rest is history. But it was just amazing having, again, known Warren through reputation, through his work, and we're going to have him back on. Now, he is, believe it or not, on tonight to talk about Charlottesville, and we're going to get to that after the break and stay there for the rest of the hour. And we're going to have Warren back on to talk a little bit more about his personal life and his activism in a subsequent episode. But, yes, when we met, same age, both have beautiful wives, both cut our teeth at the with Pat Buchanan, and then here we are now in something that transcends time and space 20 years later, two decades later, back in the same orbit and working together again. And I'm really looking forward to it, Warren. And, you know, Pat just turned 83 years old a couple of weeks ago, so...
Wow. Well, you know, it's funny.
Something to think about. But.
I'll tell you. I mean, there's a million funny stories that I could tell. You would probably find more of them more interesting than your audience would. So we won't waste too much time. But one that is interesting is when we went. I said I think it was 1999 in Flatwoods, West Virginia, which is the geographic center of West Virginia. That's where there was going to be this state Reform Party convention to decide who the nominee was going to be. And as I told you, we went and we found that Pat Buchanan himself was there. But prior to when he walked in the room, there was a contentious battle for control of it, as I said. And there was a man there, and I can say his name, Jerry Heineman, who my dad had known when we walked in. Dad said, "That's Jerry Heineman." Well, apparently, my dad's first bit of activism that he did when he was 18 years, actually, I'm sorry, he was like 16 years old. He went, or 17, he went down to join a demonstration with the NSWPP, the National Socialist White People's Party. This was during the real contentious battles of the 70s, the early 70s, like 72, 73. And the very first demonstration he went on, there were members of the National States Rights Party there, and the man who answered the door was Jerry Heineman. So all those years later, he meets Jerry again at the Reform Party in West Virginia. So you know, people tend to stay in this stuff for a long time.
I tell you what, and if time has passed, just stick with it long enough, you'll meet everybody and come around. It's just amazing to me. Warren and I were in that convention together, never met each other at the time. 20 years later, we finally met and didn't know we were there together. And the rest is history. We'll be back.
Yeah, this is David in engineering.
This is your wife in suburbia.
Oh, hi, hon. What's up?
How's the robot coming?
Well, he doesn't exactly respond to requests yet, but I'm...
Well, I know how frustrating that can be.
You do?
Uh-huh. I'm still waiting for my romantic lunch date.
Oh, yeah.
David.
Well, I must not have enough memory allocated.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
You know, your son said mama today.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Well, we'll have to have that sound chip changed to Dada.
Well, you could reprogram it yourself, you know.
I know. Hey, why don't we do it over lunch today?
Oh. You really are brilliant.
Thanks. You want me to bring the robot?
David.
He can order pasta in 11 languages.
Only if he pays for his own lunch.
Okay. Oh, don't forget to bring Chip.
I still wish we hadn't named him that.
Well, why? It beats general default.
Oh.
Family. Isn't it about time?
Do you know that a baby processes information 3 times faster than an adult?
An adult what?
Engineer. Funny.
I'll see you at noon.
I can't wait.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
If Planned Parenthood were what they publicly declare themselves to be, they would welcome transparency. We all know why they hide, because we know what they hide. We can confirm federal judges who follow the Constitution rather than reverse engineer their preferred policy outcomes. The truth about abortion is spreading because of advances in medical imaging, because of brave journalists, tireless activists, compassionate doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals. The rising generation of young Americans is the most pro-life in decades because they know too. And one day soon, we will reaffirm our nation's principles in their dignified fullness and avow once again that all men are created equal. All are entitled to life.
As a parent, is receiving a faith-based, character-focused education for your children difficult to find? Do you believe that godly principles should be a central component in your child's education? Imagine a school where faith and integrity are at its center, where heritage and responsibility instill character. For over 40 years, American Heritage School has been educating both hearts and minds, bringing out academic excellence. This is the school where character and embracing the providence of a living God are fundamental, where students' national test scores average near the 90th percentile. With American Heritage School's Advanced Distance Education Program, distance is no longer an issue. With an accredited LDS-oriented curriculum from kindergarten through 12th grade, your children can attend from anywhere in the world. American Heritage School will prepare your child for more than a job. It will prepare them for life. To learn more, visit American-Heritage.org. That's American-Heritage.org.
My friends, we must take back our cities and take back our culture and take back our country. God bless you and God bless America.
Easier said than done. That was Pat Buchanan's Culture War speech from 1992. Boy, wish I could have been there for that one. But we are now shifting gears to the Charlottesville trial with Warren Balog, who, like Trey Garrison last week and like some of the other commentators we have brought on, including Jason Kessler and Michael Hill over the course of the last month, everybody that we're having on to talk about Charlottesville has either been there or been in court or has listened to just about every minute of it. And Warren has done that, as have I. So let's go back to what's happened over the course of this week, Warren, if we can. And again, folks, I just really wanted to share that story. What a small world it is. My dad's actually texted me. My dad was there, too. Warren mentioned his father was there. My father went with me as well. And we were there, and now we're here still fighting. But this week, Warren, on November the 15th at 11:02 a.m., the 17th day of the trial, the plaintiffs rested their case. After the lunchtime recess, or the dinner recess, as we would call it in the South, the defense attorneys, one after the, another, began to present their cases. And I was thinking, okay, this will last probably a couple of weeks, perhaps not quite as long as the plaintiff's attorneys, but, you know, a lot of people, a lot of different defendants there, a lot of different attorneys. I'd say a week or two, right? A day, yeah. A day, really half of the afternoon on the 15th and the morning of the 16th, and then it went to closing arguments. Let's start there, Warren. Did that surprise you that the defense counsels collectively had such a short time or took such a short time at bat? And how do you think they did? And just break down this week's action in Charlottesville for those who weren't tuned in via audio as we were every day.
Yeah, I feel that that came as a surprise to a lot of people. I don't want to criticize the defense too much because they're operating under very difficult circumstances and they had their reasons for doing what they did. I know, for example, I mean, just like I thought it was going to go a lot longer too. But to play devil's advocate here, the strategy I believe was one, they didn't want to waste the time of the jurors any more than the plaintiffs already had, and they had gotten in most of their counterpoints and their arguments in the cross examinations of plaintiffs' witnesses in when they themselves took the stand. So, like for instance, when Chris Cantwell was on the stand, so there a lot of those arguments had already been made. And I know that they also had a lot that they wanted to say in their closing arguments. So I think I understand what the logic there was. It's just a shame, though, because you know that if the defense had $20 million and the top trial lawyers in the country on their side, it would have gone longer for a day. But I chalk it up to the limited resources that they have at their disposal. This is a real David Goliath.
Oh, no, this whole thing. Oh, it absolutely is. And I'm not saying that in criticism. I'm not litigating this case. I'm listening to it as an interested observer, as you are, as are so many people. I wasn't saying that as if it's a good or a bad thing. Just it was a remarkable thing, and it was certainly interesting and worthy of our mentioning tonight. Another thing that I found very interesting this week, really bizarrely so, was the legal definition of a conspiracy. I heard with my own ears the judge say, you can be part of a conspiracy even if it's unbeknownst to you. You can be part of a conspiracy if you set foot at the place where a conspiracy is occurring. By that loose and very wide-ranging definition, anybody could be part of a conspiracy at any time, apparently.
Yeah, it seems like first of all, it seems like the jury instructions, we all thought that Judge Moon was doing a surprisingly fair job during this trial, especially.
I did too. At least from the, pardon the interruption, Warren, at least from the bench.
Oh, okay.
There were some behind the scenes things that are very peculiar. Maybe we'll get to that later. But from the bench, with regards to how he handled each side, I thought he was fair and even handed.
He seemed to be. But I think it really. I mean, we know that they wanted this venue for a reason. We know that they wanted Judge Moon for a reason. We know that all the Charlottesville cases have been going to Judge Moon and that Judge Moon had. And I know you talked about it, I think, with Trey last week, how Judge Moon had two clerks on his – two out of three of his clerks were personal friends with Elizabeth Sines, who's the chief plaintiff in this case, and were Antifa sympathizers, and one clerk had been actually an Israeli citizen or had worked for the Israeli government. So very, 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 I mean, Judge Moon should have recused himself from this trial, absolutely.
Let me say something about that, because Sam Dixon, as I've talked to him behind the scenes a lot about this, and you know, obviously we're both close friends and following this case as interested parties, but this was something that Chris Cantwell most excellently brought out in the trial. He was questioning, cross-examining Miss Sines, and she's calling out to someone named Josh. Josh, we may need to come to your house. And he asked, who's Josh? And of course, the plaintiff's attorneys instantly objected to that, and it was sustained by Judge Moon. But Josh, of course, was one of the clerks of Judge Moon.
Yes.
And Judge Moon's 85 years old. Now, this is purely speculation on my part, but I wonder how much of the pre-trial decisions were written by him and not his clerks. That's just speculation.
Well, just the appearance of that impropriety. First of all, Judge Moon should have disclosed that. He said when Jason Kessler filed, when his attorney filed a motion to have them recuse themselves, why didn't Judge Moon go ahead and he claimed that they came to him and recused themselves at the beginning of this whole thing and that they told him about the conflict of interest. Why did he not say that? Why didn't he tell the defense, oh, by the way, before we even get started here, two of my clerks are friends of the plaintiffs and they have recused themselves. Why did it take a motion from all this Sherlock Holmes work on Facebook to try to find these connections? Why did it take that? And why did it take a motion from Kessler and his lawyer before Judge Moon disclosed this to the other side? It's very suspicious. I don't know if you know, James, but Greg Conte and I, we are together suing the city of Charlottesville, and we're suing Governor Terry McAuliffe. We have our own lawsuit that's pending from Charlottesville.
Wow, I didn't.
Greg, yeah,
that's a whole nother hour in conversation. I did not know that, but I would love to learn more.
We have not really been publicizing it, mainly because we haven't been trying to really fundraise for it, because we're doing it pro se, and all the money that can be fundraised, we thought, should be going to people that are political prisoners. There's not unlimited money out there, and we did not want to take away from the people who were fighting to stay out of prison, the Ram guys and others, the people who were involved in the DeAndre Harris incident in the garage, who were trying to stay out of prison. We don't want to distract from them, but if this, depending on how this Charlottesville trial goes, and if Kessler, because Kessler has a similar lawsuit, it's not the same. He's suing Charlottesville, but he's not suing Governor Terry McAuliffe. We are. But depending on how his case goes, they're waiting to make a ruling on something to do with our case until his case is heard in, I think, the Fourth Circuit. Greg knows more of the details of it. But the bottom line is that we submitted a motion for Judge Moon to recuse himself from this. And he denied us. I mean, he turned it down. But we put in there that one of the reasons why that he should recuse himself is the fact that he did not put this out there, that two of his clerks were friends with Elizabeth Sines and that he had Antifa clerks. So the fact that he did not disclose that until he was forced to is very suspicious. So to bring it back to the events of this week, I think that Judge Moon is absolutely, I don't want to say it too much, but I think that there's a reason why the plaintiffs chose him and why they chose his court and why they wanted to have it in Charlottesville. Just the fact that they're having it in Charlottesville is unbelievably prejudicial to the case because of so much of the heated emotions in the city of Charlottesville. Well, and the jurors are going to be going back to their friends and neighbors, and they're going to have to answer for whatever decision they make. So just that alone, you would think that this wouldn't have gone to trial, or it would have been changed venue.
To play devil's advocate, and I'm asking this just as a member of the audience, if not in Charlottesville where the event occurred, where would they or could they have had it?
Oh, I know when there's a trial like that, you know, when there's an incident like that in a town, you move it out of the locale because the local emotions are too strong. You know, there's too many, everybody's polarized and people can't look at it objectively and unbiasedly because they've been personally affected.
It's a good observation. It's a fantastic observation there. We're going to take a break. We've got Warren for the remainder of the hour. He's going to be joined now, though, by a man who testified in Charlottesville this week. We're going to expand the roundtable to three when we come back. So stay tuned.
Proclaiming liberty across the land. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. USA Radio News with Chris Barnes.
A security scare at a busy Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport in Atlanta leaves three people with non-life-threatening injuries in a panic that followed the false reports of an active shooter at the airport. They say, in fact, there was no active shooter. No serious injuries were reported, though those three did end up having to be treated at the scene. This is coming as millions of Americans are, of course, starting to travel for the Thanksgiving holiday. A Georgia judge denying a defense motion for a mistrial in the Ahmaud Arbery murder case. His Arbery family lawyer, Lee Merritt, says it means the trial's going to resume on Monday.
Prosecution has granted this jury more than enough evidence to find these men guilty on all charges.
The three suspects say they believed that the victim was a burglar and they were attempting to make a citizen's arrest. And this is USA.
Just in time for Christmas, Mike Lindell has dropped the price of the standard classic My Pillow, regularly $69.98 to $19.98. Now, queen and king size slightly higher, but that price includes a free press and pack bag so you can take your My Pillow with you anywhere. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square, use my promo code USA, or call 1-800-951-8175. Support Mike Lindell and American Jobs and give My Pillow for Christmas.
Maybe this is you too. A lot of people do not like their health plan right now, but great news, you're not stuck with it. There's another choice called MediShare, and it's a great option if you're self-employed or changing jobs or part of the gig economy. The typical family saves $500 a month with MediShare, and the customer satisfaction rate is double that of typical health insurance. Find out more, including how much you'll save. Just call 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE.
Protests and demonstrations in city streets across the nation. No, not about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, although, as we told you, there have been some of those in the United States. But it's Austria where you've been hearing this, as a national lockdown and a plan to mandate COVID-19 vaccinations has been issued. Coronavirus infections in that European nation have hit a record high. Thousands of demonstrators, though, gathering in Vienna today to protest the new restrictions. Joe Exotic, no longer in a Texas prison where he's been. The Tiger King star has been transferred from that correctional facility in Fort Worth to a federal medical center in North Carolina, as a social media account run by his lawyer says he's been diagnosed with cancer.
and the transfer is part of his treatment. The second season of Tiger King is going to be seen on Netflix. And this is USA Radio News.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rich Hamblin is joining the call now, a dear friend of ours here at TPC, longtime friend of the family. He and his wife are really part of the family. And he showed us the way this week by going up to Charlottesville. And I got to say this about Rich, and I said it earlier this week with Sam Bushman. I was on Sam's show a couple of times this week to break down the trial out in Utah. Rich, to my knowledge, was the only person who was not either a plaintiff or a defendant or a so-called expert witness, and the plaintiff's attorneys really redefined the word expert over the course of this trial, but Rich was the only person to go up there who was accosted by Antifa, who was attacked by Antifa, physically attacked by Antifa, who went up there to testify on behalf of the defense. Everybody else was too scared to be doxxed, too scared to be pulled back into it. Rich was the only one with the stones to go up there. And he lived out of the jurisdiction. He lived beyond 150-mile radius of Charlottesville. They could not subpoena him to come. They could not compel him to come. He went on his own volition. He drove a day up there and a day back to have an hour on the stand. And he's going to tell us about it right now. And then he's going to join the discussion in progress with Warren Balog. And what a great job Warren's doing tonight. But Rich, well, hey, listen, for the people who have and have not been listening to this trial as we have, tell us what it was like to be in that court with all of these different people that we've been listening to sit right there by the judge and to face the jury and to tell your story. Take us there.
Well, as you know, it's not the first time I've been in a federal courtroom, but this one was a little different. It was, it's like going through, I don't know, TSA times 10 to get into the court. It's kind of funny. I met my attorney, or I met the league attorney, Brian Jones, at his office. We went over things, and then we went over to the courthouse, and at the front door there was, lo and behold, Matt Parrott, you know. And he goes, "Hey, it's been a long time." And I said, "Yeah, I was sitting on the front steps of the police station last time I saw you." You know, just after the fight.
Yeah, because this was your first time to go back since the day of the event, of course. So yeah, I mean, yeah, what was it like going back to Charlottesville?
Well, it was it was quite different. It was much calmer. There was didn't see any Antifa around. I think when we walked into the courthouse, there was maybe one reporter out on the street doing a piece. With no protesters, none of that kind of stuff. The word I heard was that they were being kind of quiet because they thought it would look bad if they tried to attack anybody. But Seville Fash Watch did make up a wanted poster, pretty much, for me and Matt Parrott. But I was already out of town by the time it got posted on the internet. But yeah, they were mighty agitated that I had the nerve to come back, I guess, and especially
Molly
Conger.
Gotta say again, the only guy who went back up there who was physically assaulted by a so-called counter protester, and we tip our hat to you, sir, for that. And of course, yeah, to be in the courtroom had to be quite a thing, to be there in the presence of the pro se counsel, the defense counsel that we've been listening to, obviously the plaintiff's counsel, and I heard you tell that they were scowling throughout your entire recollection of the day's events. But and Rich was also featured, in a manner of speaking, in the Netflix documentary. I don't know if it was made for Netflix, but you can certainly find it there. Alt-Right: The Age of Rage. You can actually watch Rich's interaction with Antifa up close and personal in that documentary that I think was presented at Cannes and some of these other major film festivals. So a true celebrity on our hands now. But of course, Rich, I know you are an admirer of Warren. And in fact, when you heard that Warren was going to be on the show tonight, you asked if you could join the conversation with him because you wanted to speak personally with him. So he's been listening to this as we have. I'm going to turn it over to both you and him now. What would you like to say to Warren?
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you on the phone. I've watched some of your presentations on the internet, and I know you're an expert on somewhat on Hungarian politics and all that kind of stuff. But I knew of Emily before I heard of Warren, because I used to she used to be on Red Ice and
well,
some programs
course.
Back in the day. And what was she, the peanut lady at the Phillies game? So I remember Emily well, and I'm glad that you two are a couple.
Thank you very much, sir. Yeah, and that's that's fantastic. Like I said, until James mentioned it, I didn't know. I had missed when you were there, because I wasn't listening the whole week, you know. But let me ask you, because I'm very curious. What was your perception of the jury, or or did you have a chance to just see the types of people? I've heard that there seems to be a lot of like working class people, which gives me some hope.
You know, I couldn't really tell. I didn't start listening to the trial until the arguments began to be made. So I didn't listen to any of the jury selection. I know that Kessler thinks that there was about four people on the jury that were well disposed. I know that one got dismissed Friday for the young man that had a bad experience and was attacked for being white in Hawaii when he was growing up. I know he was dismissed because his children had been exposed to COVID at school, and you know they were quarantined, so he was quarantined too. Everybody in the courtroom was wearing a mask. It was so it's really difficult to get a read on anybody. Plus, the jury was not in the jury box; they were scattered out in the gallery. You know, they're 6 feet apart and all that kind of stuff. I only really got a look at one of them. When I was on the way out, and he was an older white gentleman, looks like probably in 60s, maybe even 70, retired guy. He sort of looked working class to me for sure. But to look at the jury, I had to look over the defense, the plaintiff's table, and they were an ugly bunch, and their attitudes weren't all that
My experience when I was there, I got maced. I didn't get maced. I got hit with pepper spray by the Charlottesville police pretty badly. And, with the combination of the sunburn, because I'd been out, I didn't have any kind of protection on, and there was a medic tent there, and I just went to get checked out because I was breathing really heavy, and I have high blood pressure, and I was having a bad time, and there was a medic tent right there, so I went and got checked out, and while I was in there, I'm really glad that happened, because while I was in there, there were two guys that were injured from our side, and all the nurses there were local women, and I grew up in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, which is not, it's right across the border from Virginia. It's similar culture to Southwest Virginia,
right,
which Charlottesville isn't really in that Southwest Virginia, but it's just the kind of people down there are similar to the people that I grew up around. And the sense I got at the time was that the local people completely were on our side. It was more the town, the people with money, liberals with money, affluent liberals in the town itself that were all on the side of the Antifa and wanting to pull the statue down. But the sense I get is people in the surrounding area were totally sympathetic to us and to wanting to keep the Lee statue up. And I wonder if you thought the same. I mean, it just seemed like good, solid, Virginia people.
That's probably true. I mean, we had a little bit of interaction with the 15 or 20 cops that sat around and did nothing while I was getting knocked to the ground there in front of the police station. And I was, one of them was kind enough to pick me up and walk me over to the side and said, look, you're too old to be doing this sort of thing. So we, after the uproar died down, I was talking to one of them, and I said, hey, look at all this overtime you're getting. And he said, man, I'd rather be anywhere else except here. So, I kind of got that feeling. You got to understand that UVA is probably the biggest thing in Charlottesville. And of course, like any other college around the country, it's full of communists and shit libs and whatever you want to call them. That's just a culture. And they're the ones that have taken over. My wife and I, my ex-wife and I passed through there about, around 2000 or 2001 when we were taking our son up to school at the University of Pennsylvania. And we stopped in there because she was a former Spanish teacher in a local prep school. And she wanted to stop by, and see where one of her students was, living. And so we drove through there, and it just looked like it looked like a quiet, peaceful college town, with pizza joints and all that kind of paraphernalia. When we arrived in Charlottesville on Friday afternoon, we took even though our quarters, the place we were staying, the retreat center was outside Charlotte and Charlottesville in a place called Madison. We took a drive through the town to see what it was like, and I did not get the same vibe then.
Yeah.
Hold on right there, gentlemen. I can tell you, I could go the full 3 hours with these two guys. What fantastic guests. And they're going to be with us for another segment. Rich is actually going to rejoin us in the third hour. We'll have Ramsey Paul in the middle to talk about Rittenhouse. But we're going to revisit. We're going to have a redux on Charlottesville with Rich in the third hour. So stay for all of it.
As the United States boldly stepped forward in the glorious light provided by its new Constitution in 1787, the nations of the earth were in awe of the newfound strength and hope of this free land. Today, the nation stands at a crossroads. A divergence from the original intent put forth in the United States Constitution has brought grave threats to our beloved nation. A miracle is needed if the United States is to survive. That miracle is, again, the pure application of the United States Constitution. I'm Scott Bradley. In my To Preserve the Nation book and lecture series, I bring forth truths that will help raise up a new generation of statesmen like those noble Americans who founded this land. Vigorous application of these principles will invigorate and restore the nation, and we may become again the freest, most prosperous, most respected, and happiest nation on earth. Visit topreservethenation.com to begin that restoration.
Okay, girls, about finished with your lesson on money?
Daddy, what is a buy-sell spread for gold coins?
Well, when you sell a gold coin to a coin shop that's worth, say, $1,200, you don't actually get $1,200. But don't worry, we're members of UPMA now, so we don't have to worry about that.
Daddy, what if somebody steals our gold?
We don't have any gold at the house. It's stored safely in the UPMA vault, securely and insured.
But the S&P 500 outperformed gold. Daddy, gold is a bad investment.
Some people do think of it that way. But actually, gold is money. And as members of the United Precious Metals Association, we can use our gold at any store, just like a credit card. Or I can ask them to drop it right into Mommy and Daddy's bank account, because we're a UPMA member family. Find out more at upma.org. That's upma.org.
Why don't we say to the government writ large that they have to spend a little bit less? Anybody ever had less money this year than you had last? Anybody better have a 1% pay cut? You deal with it. That's what government needs, a 1% pay cut. If you take a 1% pay cut across the board, you have more than enough money to actually pay for the disaster relief. But nobody's going to do that because they're fiscally irresponsible. Who are they? Republicans. Who are they? Democrats. Who are they? Virtually the whole body is careless and reckless with your money. So the money will not be offset by cuts anywhere. The money will be added to the debt. And there will be a day of reckoning. What's the day of reckoning? The day of reckoning may well be the collapse of the stock market. The day of reckoning may be the collapse of the dollar. When it comes, I can't tell you exactly, but I can tell you it has happened repeatedly in history when countries ruin their currency.
Welcome back. To get on the show, call us on James's Dime at 1-866-986-6397.
I want to move very hastily because we have far too little time for what I want to cover. I want to thank again Warren Balog. We'll have him back on to talk more about his activism, and he's doing a lot. He's got his own live stream. He's obviously working with a political party, and we're going to have him back on to tell us all about that once these cases are settled. But I want to say this again about Rich Hamblin. Going up there, he was solid, he was poised, he was steady under fire. proud to know him. He mentioned very briefly, I should probably follow up on this, about the juror who was dismissed. We did get to listen to the jury selection process. This was juror number 210. Juror number 210, they had asked these racially charged questions in the jury selection process. And he had answered that the only racism I have ever experienced was being attacked because I was white. And I think he had some not so kind things to say about the Black Lives Matter movement. He was able to get on the jury, but between the time that closing arguments ended and jury deliberations began, I guess it's just bad luck that his kid got exposed to COVID at school, and through that he was exposed. I don't want to get off into black helicopters or anything like that, but that's unfortunate, because he was one that, you know, obviously you would think might be sympathetic. So that one was lost. This is a civil trial, not a criminal trial, so 11 jurors, you don't have to have an alternate, on they go. So anyway, that's the update on that. But they are still in deliberation. This thing went into deliberation very early in the morning on Friday. Who knows when you're reading tea leaves what that means? Is it good or bad that they are still in deliberation and didn't start handing out jackpots on Friday? Who knows? We'll find out. I bet you this thing will end on Monday, though, so stay tuned. Our next show will give you the summation, but it's all over but the shouting, that's for sure. I want to read James, something very quickly. Was that you? Yeah, go ahead, Warren.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject, because I don't want to let our 10 minutes go by without saying what I wanted most to say, which is that Christopher Cantwell did an incredible job in his closing.
Yes, thank you. He was absolutely
amazing. The whole trial, he did great. In the closing arguments, I felt the best ones were, I felt that actually the only ones that were any good of the closing arguments, because I heard Karen Dunn, who is a horrible person, but she's one of the top trial lawyers in the country, and she is a very, very aggressive person. She's the only one of all the attorneys, I think, for the plaintiffs that is not Jewish, and by Jewish I mean like an absolute caricature of a New York Jew. She's the only one that appears to be non-Jewish, but she's very aggressive, and I noticed she led the opening and closing arguments. She carried the most weight with it, and she's worked for some of the top corporations in the country, so it's a very big guns to go up against. And I felt Richard Spencer actually did a surprisingly good job in his closing arguments. The Josh Smith, the TWP lawyer, who didn't have a lot of time to prepare for this trial, and he doesn't have a lot of experience as a trial lawyer, from what I know, certainly nothing like the other side, he did well. Jones, the league attorney, did phenomenal. He did great. I feel like he's the only one of the defense attorneys that really Josh Smith also, but he especially earned his paycheck. But Cantwell came out and gave, I wish I'd had a recording of that, and I think that was the reaction across the board. Cantwell is the hero of this trial, and he will emerge that way no matter what.
Yeah, let me make some comments on Cantwell. He turned himself into the true leader. He was there for everybody.
Hear.
He even helped salvage some of the idiotic stuff that Spencer said. And when I was the last, I was the next to last witness. I think the Newberry came on after me, and I didn't get to hear him because I was going out of the courtroom when he testified. But on Jones tested, examined me for 30 minutes, and then the learned elder Levine got up and tried to tear me apart for the next 30 minutes, and then Cantwell and Josh Smith got up, and both of them drew attention to the helmet that Rachel Miles was wearing, and asked me if I recognized the symbol that was on it. And during the course of this, they had to put the part of the videotape up where I'm getting pummeled on the ground, showing the side of her head. And Cantwell and they were asking if I knew what that meant. I said, well, I didn't really know what it was until I hadn't heard of it until the trial. And they said, what does it look like? I said, well, it looks like, three lines. They said, could it be arrows? I said, well, yeah, sure. But the point of that was, it was the last thing the jury saw after my cross-examination from Levine. So, I mean, it brought up the fact that, I got knocked to the pavement and hit 4 or 5 times. And
unprovoked. I mean, it's got to be said unprovoked. You were trying to get to your car. You were trying to get out of there as you were instructed.
Yeah, they
to
tried
do.
To steal my flag. I resisted, and then three of them turned on me, and we wrestled around. I was just trying to get away from them, and she ended up kicking my legs out from under me. And all this is in front of about 15 or 20 Charlottesville cops and deputies. I mean, they're all standing over there.
You can see it for yourself.
They were out for blood that day, man. They were out for blood. I got hit in the arm from behind as we were being pushed out of the park by a black guy who was wearing a mask. And I remember that because it really stuck in my mind. They had made such a thing about how they were not going to let anybody wear masks, the Charlottesville police.
Yeah.
He hit me with a club in the elbow, and it was very minor. I lost feeling in my arm for like an hour or two, and it was a big bruise. It wasn't that bad. But what happened to you, I mean, there were so many people that had worse than when I was in that medical tent. There were people with bandages, blood running down their face, big head wounds. I mean, we had medics there. There were women. There were a lot of women that were on our side that were there that were helping out, helping people with wounds. There were a lot of injuries that went unreported, but it was just so disgusting. And I'm sure it was for you too, Rich, to hear Levine and Kaplan and these people make it talk about the joyous celebrating counter demonstration. They were just peaceful students and everything. I mean, they are such filthy liars, and they know they're lying. They know that they are lying. And it really is. There were times when I just had white knuckles listening to some of this testimony and the lies coming out of these lawyers.
I can tell you they know they're lying because they accuse all the witnesses on our side of lying.
Yes.
You know, it's a typical projection. You know,
well,
he cries out and he strikes you. You know, that whole thing.
He made a great point about how our side was the one that's almost trying to show you the full clip in context. They're the ones trying to show you the little, Jones did that. And I have to make another point. Yeah, Jones did it. And I have to make another point because this is really infuriating. This is what's called a slap lawsuit, strategic lawsuit against public participation.
Yeah. Yes.
Everyone
tried to
knows
bring that up. Yep.
Yeah, and it is in every single story in the news media. There's a paragraph where the liberal press is saying, oh, the purpose of this lawsuit, according to the plaintiff's lawyers, is to bankrupt these organizations so they're not able to function anymore as political organizations. Over and over and over again, they say that's what the purpose of it is. Yet when Richard tried to bring that point up, and when Cantwell and others have tried to put it up, Kaplan objects. Judge Moon shuts them down. You're not allowed to talk about anything, and this isn't has
yeah,
nothing to
that's
do
right.
with the case.
Hey,
I mean, it's like everywhere out of the question. And you know, and this is what I said on my Telegram, that if they get what they want out of this, every single interview for the rest of her life, Kaplan is going to be bragging about how this hopefully cripples the ability of our guys, groups like the League of the South, to go out there and politically organize. So before the trial, during the trial, right, as long as it's not in the courtroom, and after the trial, they're bragging about it to how it's a slap lawsuit. But when Judge Moon, when you try to bring it up in his courtroom, he shuts you down.
Outrageous. Guys, it's a great radio interview when I feel as though we haven't covered half of it, and it's flown by, and we only have a couple of minutes left, and this has just been amazing. We are going to have, listen, again, Ramsey Paul's in the second hour. We're going to talk about Rittenhouse. That's big news, too. And then in the third hour, Rich and I are going to team back up to give a final assessment of Charlottesville. So stay tuned for the whole 3 hours tonight. You don't want to miss it. But, Warren, you wrote this. If you don't think Charlottesville case of Sines versus Kessler matters, or if you are indifferent towards the defendants because you have a disagreement with some of them politically, I would challenge you to consider this. If the Bolsheviks have their way, it sets a precedent that the right of free speech and self-defense can summarily be stripped from you without even a rubber stamp of judicial review based merely on your unpopularity in the eyes of the far left. Let's finish with that. And my God, guys, it's gone by, I say again, too quickly. We have about a minute left. Warren, final word to you. Rich, you'll be back with me in the third hour. But the effects of free speech and free assembly in this country and how this case weighs in on that.
Yeah, well, that's what the purpose of it is to shut down free speech. They say that's what it's for. If you try to bring it up, you can't bring it up in Judge Moon's courtroom. Hopefully the jury sees through that. I'm praying to God that jury, that there's some common sense or some fairness or some decency there, that these people see through this. And I can't go, James, without saying how delighted I am about Kyle Rittenhouse and how that shows that it is possible for truth to prevail and for the good guys to win. It doesn't happen often, but it still is possible as long as you stay in the fight, you keep your chin up, you keep optimistic, you don't give an inch to these people. You know, you keep doing what you've been doing since the Reform Party. You keep fighting, keep speaking up. And eventually we have some victories, and Kyle Rittenhouse gives me hope. Hopefully that's a good omen of things to come with both the Charlottesville trial and the McMichaels trial down there. Another one that we all need to start paying attention to right now, because conservatives don't want to touch it, Republicans, but it's something that we all need to pay attention to.
I said that, Warren, too. If the races had been reversed with regards to those who had been shot, the conservatives would have been for the McMichaels, and they would have left Rittenhouse out to hang. And I think that's the only thing that saved Rittenhouse. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that the same justice is served in Georgia and, of course, in Charlottesville as well. But I was glad that the establishment conservatives gave Rittenhouse the support that he deserved, and I'm so glad that that kid got off. I got to admit, I teared up watching his reaction to the verdict.
Me too. Me too.
I don't think conservatives would have touched him from a mile away if those people had been black. And anyway, that's where we'll leave it. Warren Balog, thank you so much. Thank you for your work and your leadership. We'll talk to you again soon about other matters and a more wide-ranging political talk. Rich, we'll talk to you again in a couple of hours, so stay tuned. Much more to come tonight here on TPC. Ramsey Paul's up next. You know where